I'm speaking today with Houston City Attorney David Feldman. We're going to talk about a number of topics, but the main thing that drew me to want to talk to you was redistricting, since that's something we don't see, at least not on this scale, in the city of Houston very often. So let me start off by asking, what exactly is your role as city attorney in the redistricting process?
Well, the legal department is playing a central role. First, in terms of establishing the steps that we have to follow in order to meet the requirements of our charter, which triggers the addition of two council seats if the 2010 shows a population in excess of 2.1 million, which we obviously assume that it will. We also have to ensure that the redistricting process that we follow is in compliance with the Voting Rights Act of 65. We have to make certain also that we are able to, when it's all said and done, and a plan is adopted by council, that it's one that meets all the requisite tests and that can, for which we can obtain preclearance from DOJ. And we will be putting the preclearance request, our submission, together, the legal department will. And then, of course, we will have to, you know, spearhead the defense of any litigation that ensues following that.
Okay. Now, it's the planning department that is doing the actual number crunching and drawing the maps, but the legal department is kind of walking hand in hand with them along the way to make sure that they're working within these parameters you've laid out.
Correct. I mean, we are not demographers, we are not planners, but we do know the law. And this is a process that really has three components. Certainly it has a heavily regulated legal component. It has the planning component, and it also has a political component.
Okay. Now, it was, you know, a lawsuit from, I believe, what, 1979 that kind of, you know, kicked off a long series of events that led to this. Can you just kind of briefly go over that history?
Sure. There was the, you know, prior to, you know, 79, we had a system where all council members were elected at large, eight council members and of course, the mayor. Although some had to reside within certain areas of the city, it wasn't a single-member district. It was all at large. As a result of the 79 litigation, both and the involvement of the Justice Department, you know, eventually the city went to the what has become known as the current 951 plan. And at the time, the charter was amended to adopt that plan. There was also the provision inserted regarding the 2.1 million trigger for the addition of two seats to make it instead an 11-5-1 plan. At the time, that provision, the rationale for that provision was the anticipation of additional annexations. It wasn't contemplated that it wouldn't go, the 2.1 million trigger wouldn't be, you know, reached for 30 years, as is the case. But nevertheless, it's in there, so we're reaching it. The litigation that followed really were more rabbit trails than anything else. It didn't actually lead to, obviously, any change. The system was upheld. The efforts to get the 2.1 million trigger pulled earlier failed, and that was started in 2009. So we're really working off of the 1979 system as we speak.
Okay. And now, there are some things in redrawing these lines, there are some things that need to be done, and there are some things that, you know, you'd kind of like to be able to do. Can you talk about what, you know, what are the requirements? I believe, for example, you know, when we talk about the Voting Rights Act, what does that require in terms of drawing the map? And then what other considerations, what other things are going to be taken into consideration that, you know, you'd like to be able to do in drawing the map?
Well, the difficulty here, and what makes it so unique, is that you have to add two seats. In a typical redistricting, there's no compulsion to add any particular number of districts. And typically, what redistricting entails is basically reshuffling the deck to accommodate changes in population. You still have the same number of representatives. Here, uniquely, you have to add to and at the same time deal with the increase in population. So more districts and, by necessity, smaller districts population-wise.
Well, the original litigation over, you know, all at large that led to single member districts really had as much to do with the fact that it was difficult for minorities to get elected.
Was the motivating factor.
And so, you know, we have some districts that are, you know, we currently have two districts that are, you know, African American. We have two districts that are Latino. You know, the other litigation that you alluded to previously that wanted to get this process started a few years ago was essentially to spur the creation of another Latino district. Do you believe that is an outcome that is required, or is that something that, you know, maybe will happen, you know, would be nice to happen maybe, but maybe not?
It's certainly not required, I think very clearly it was not anticipated back in 1979 when that charter amendment was adopted. I think it needs to be recognized that the Hispanic population, although ever-growing, is not a geographically compact population. It's not a homogeneous population. It's spread throughout the city. And while certainly it's understandable that there are persons and segments of the Hispanic community that would like to see one or two new, quote, Hispanic districts. How it all falls out, no one knows. And certainly we can't even begin to conjecture as to what these districts might look like in terms of both location and demographics until the census numbers come in. I mean, experience tells us that we can make all kinds of assumptions as to where the growth has been. You know, popular wisdom would tell you that the growth is more to the west. But there are always surprises when those census numbers come out. And we just have to wait and see what they, you know, what they look like. The, you know, there are some certain fundamental principles that you have to follow in connection with redistricting, you know, coming from the Supreme Court case law, starting with, you know, Baker versus Carr in '62, as also embodied in the Voting Rights Act of '65 as amended. I mean, and the first major principle is there can't be any retrogression. You can't move backwards in terms of minority representation. You have to avoid packing. You have to avoid fracturing. There are certain, you know, criteria that you can look to, that the courts have recognized, that you can look to in terms of drawing the lines. But so much is going to be dictated, insofar as the line drawing is concerned, so much is going to be dictated by, you know, where the population growth has been and where do you fit those two new districts into this pie that was 9 pieces and now has to be 11 pieces. I suspect the drawing, if you will begin by with what we would call the stressed areas, the areas where there has been some significant population growth, and it appears that there may be an underrepresentation of minorities.
Okay. You've mentioned the Justice Department and preclearance. For other redistrictings, this is kind of the first time that there's been a Democratic Justice Department after a decennial redistricting since, well, I don't know, maybe I don't know if it's ever even. Not a 91, not an 81.
No, that's right.
Do you think that will make the process any different?
No. Throughout my practice in representing governmental entities, I've had to deal with the DOJ, and what I've found is that regardless of who the Attorney General is, the Civil Rights Division of the Department of Justice still kind of does its own thing. The cadre in the Civil Rights Division, the attorneys that make it move, they survive regardless of party. And I think you would find that, at least in terms of the people, the lawyers who do the day-to-day work, there's not going to be a change, and there never has been, in my experience, a change in their approach to preclearance. They apply the Voting Rights Act of 1965. I mean, I've seen it in prior redistrictings where the fact that it was a Republican administration didn't impact the vigorous enforcement of the Voting Rights Act, in at least in terms of preclearance of local governmental entity changes.
Okay. Now, this is all kind of on a very tight time schedule, since this has to be for an election this year, not next year. Are you concerned that there might be? Well, first of all, how confident are you in the ability to meet the deadlines, and how concerned are you that there will be litigation once some maps start to appear?
The key on the timelines is it all comes down to when does the census data come out. The earlier it comes out, the better off we are in meeting the timelines. The later it comes out, the worse off we are.
Right now we're anticipating it in, what, mid-February?
Yes. We adopted our schedule based on the assumption that we would have it by the end of February. If we have it by mid-February, which is what the present, what we're hearing from Washington, that'll give us a two-week jump. But if it winds up going into March, we're going to hurt. It's going to be that much more difficult.
And, what about the threat of litigation? Is there any concern about that? I mean,
well, it's ever present. This area of the law has been marked by litigation. There are, too many groups out there that can certainly take advantage of the ability to file suit under Voting Rights Act 65 to think that somebody would not avail themselves of that possibility. Obviously a lot comes down to how the lines are drawn. Whether or not it appears that the lines will likely enable greater minority representation or not. Again, there can't be any retrogression. The key here is, will there be progression in terms of minority representation? And I would anticipate that if the redistricting doesn't yield an increase in minority representation, that in turn increases the likelihood of litigation, especially from, say, LULAC, based on Hispanic growth.
Okay. Now, of course, beyond racial and ethnic group concerns, there are different neighborhoods that have their own concerns about wanting to be together, wanting to be joined with this neighborhood or that, or not be joined with this neighborhood or that. How much of that is taken into account?
A lot. Districts are formed by voting precincts. So you would never divide up a voting precinct. But what you, and those precincts change. But what you try to do as best you can is keep neighborhoods and communities together in the same district. That is very much a consideration. That's a consideration of utmost importance as you're drawing new lines.
And what kind of input from citizens, who may have an interest in some aspect of the process, what kind of input from them is most effective in actually getting what they want?
Well, we're very fortunate in that our primary consultant, Jerry Woods, has been doing, knows Houston well, and has been working on redistricting matters since the 80s, and is thus familiar with a lot of the different neighborhoods and communities that compose what is the second largest city in the country geographically. But hearing from individual citizens in terms of what they consider their neighborhoods to be, what their communities of interest are, what their preferences and concerns are in terms of maintaining a sense of community insofar as voting is concerned, that's important.
Is there any one way that's better than another of giving that feedback?
Well, the process that we're utilizing is one that is intended to maximize citizen input. So, for example, while we're not required by law to have town hall meetings, in fact, that's what we're going to be doing throughout the month of March, before we actually even put out a preliminary plan. We get the census data, we start working on the plan, but while we're working on the plan, we have the town hall meetings, and there's going to be one meeting in each council district, except for the district that covers Cambridge and Cambridge?
E.
Except E, which will have two. One meeting up in Kingwood and one meeting down in Clear Lake. We chose to have a meeting in each single member district, just to sort of to diffuse where the meetings were. That doesn't mean that you have to live in a particular district to go to the town hall meeting in that district. Anybody can go to any town hall meeting wherever it's held. But we're going to have, therefore, 10 town hall meetings throughout the month of March to explain the process to citizens, but more importantly, to get their thoughts, their input, their considerations, their concerns, as we are actually trying to draw lines. Then, of course, in April, after a plan is developed, we'll have public hearings with respect to the plan.
And there will be the opportunity to affect the lines that have been drawn in those.
Not only to come into the public hearing and do it, but also to submit alternate plans. Any citizen will have the ability to come to the planning department, go to a kiosk. One of the things that every time you have redistricting, your technology is better and better. So the software that's available today obviously wasn't even in anybody's imagination back in 2000, for example, or 2001. So a sophisticated system is available that citizens can come use. There will be somebody there to help them figure out how to do it. And people can draw their own lines. They can, you know, submit plans. Now, whether or not they meet the criteria of the Voting Rights Act of 65 is another question, you know, altogether. But I suspect in an instance like this where you're adding two districts, there will be all kinds of ideas with respect to alternative plans.
Well, I'm glad you mentioned that, because as you know, there is, you know, freely available software out there that allows people to, you know, draw their own maps for whatever political entity. And you know, Mayor Parker, in a recent council member, made mention of this, talking about, you know, I didn't think it was good for people to be drawing quote-unquote fantasy maps.
What she was referring to when she said fantasy map is drawing maps before you have census data. Because how can you possibly draw lines if you don't know where the population is? You've got to wait for the census data to come out. Once the census data comes out, then there won't be fantasy maps.
Well, you could get an approximation based on 2009 estimates. It would have to be adjusted, of course.
Well, it's just that. It's an approximation, and as I said before, there's never been a census that how many have we had since the 60s? But there never has been one where there weren't surprises.
Okay. Normally every 10 years, I assume the city just sort of, as you said previously, just sort of reshuffles things to adjust for population growth here or not there, to make sure that all the districts are, you know, roughly equivalent in size. I mean, going forward after this, do we expect in 2021, I mean, hard to predict the future, but do you expect there to be any future redistricting situations like this where more districts will be added, or you think it's just going to be, you know, we'll keep the same number of districts and just move stuff around as needed?
No, not unless Houstonians, get it in their head that they want to be like New York or Los Angeles and have city councils that, you know, with 25, 30, you know, 50 members, that kind of thing. No, I don't anticipate this city, you know, going beyond an 11 5-1 system, certainly in my lifetime.
Okay. All right. Now, obviously, there are things that the city attorney does that don't involve redistricting, and I want to ask you a couple of questions about some of these.
Just a few.
Yeah. Most recently, the city council passed a new ordinance having to do with changing the ethics laws. Having to do with lobbying. There was some criticism from, you know, some kind of the public watchdog types that the law that was passed, you know, wasn't effective. That it didn't really do much of anything, it didn't really change much of anything. How do you respond to that?
Well, I took it very much to heart because this office was obviously heavily involved in drafting the revisions to the ethics ordinance. There were some sweeping changes that were made to try to bring it into the 21st century. And the criticism or criticisms of the watchdog group that I saw as published in the Chronicle were very narrowly focused and nearsighted. They took exception to one particular change in the draft amendments, which clarified that with respect to the definition of the term benefit as used in the standards of conduct, that the exceptions that were in place for gifts under the penal code were utilized. That is a very narrow point, and it really as a result they lost sight of the sweeping revisions that existed or that were carried out in the revised ordinance. And by way of example, we added standards of conduct which addressed types of conflict that had never been addressed, conflict of interest that had never been addressed before, and aren't addressed in other jurisdictions. They totally ignored the fact that for the first time, a violation of the standards of conduct in the ethics ordinance would be a Class C misdemeanor, a criminal offense.
Not a civil offense.
Not a civil offense, a criminal offense. They also lost sight of the fact that has significance not simply in the city being able to effectively prosecute ethics violations itself, but that also ties into the Texas Penal Code in a broader sense, because there is the offense of abuse of official capacity that's in the Texas Penal Code, which at a minimum is a Class B misdemeanor, which means jail time. And abuse of official capacity occurs if a public official violates a law relating to their position for the purpose of obtaining a benefit or causing detriment to another. Well, now a violation of our standard of conduct is a law relating to employment or one's position. So prosecution under our ordinance can actually in turn lead to prosecution under the penal code as well in a given situation. And that's quite significant. They lost sight of the fact that we tightened up the lobbying registration requirements, require more people to register as lobbyists and to report, to disclose expenditures. Lost sight of the changes in the revolving door. So they focused on a small piece, and what was of particular interest and I guess to some degree amusement to me was that one of the individuals quoted was saying, as I recall, that, oh, well, you know, now they can be taken to dinner, and they can be wined and dined, and that's going to be permitted. That's not going to be a violation. Of course, it never was. If it was with a vendor, but what these same people were saying that, well, we as lobbyists for public interest groups, that's what we do to lobby. We take people out to dinner. So this is a lobbyist complaining about the city not prohibiting the very activity that they engage in to effect changes in ethics laws.
I guess, to me, the big gap in ethics laws in the state are, lax enforcement.
Yes.
The Texas Ethics Commission, they don't go out looking for violators as a general rule. They act when someone reports something. Is the city going to be proactive?
Absolutely. And I tried to bring that point home. We would not have criminalized violations of the standards of conduct unless we intended to prosecute those violations. And we have developed alternative avenues for those violations to be ferreted out and to be prosecuted. The capabilities of what used to be the Ethics Committee, and it's now the Houston Ethics Commission, have been enhanced. They can bring matters up on their own. It does not have to be based on the complaint of a citizen. And they can refer matters for investigation to the Office of Inspector General, which has been beefed up as well. Separate and apart from that, I can refer matters, the mayor can refer matters for investigation by the Inspector General. And if there is evidence of any ethics violation, they will be prosecuted.
Okay. The red light camera referendum that was voted on last year, there's a lawsuit over that. Can you tell me where that stands right now? What are we waiting on, and when do we anticipate something?
The matter remains pending before Judge Hughes in federal court. We anticipate a preliminary decision any day now. Preliminary decision in that the court concluded that it needed to rule on the validity of the constitutional amendment, the charter amendment first, before going to the issue of the rights and obligations of the city and the camera company ATS under the contract that exists. So it's essentially bifurcated the case. We brought the lawsuit in the first instance when we turned the cameras off because we do have a contract that would otherwise run until 2014. Rather than just sit idly by and face the prospect of a substantial damages claim, we elected to file suit so that we could have a speedy declaration of the rights of the city under the contract. But it is in that context that the issue of validity of the election has been raised, and we anticipate the court's ruling on that issue, as I said, any day.
Now, the issue of the validity was brought up, prior to the election, after the petition signatures were submitted. You and a couple of council members, including, I believe, Councilmember Clutterbuck, had a disagreement over whether that election should have happened at all. Right. Can you talk a little bit about what was the crux of that disagreement? And if the judge now rules that this election shouldn't have happened at all, does that affect how does that affect what the city does?
In answer to the first question, the disagreement was over the basic issue of whether a charter amendment could be utilized to effectively repeal an ordinance. The red light cameras are permitted by state law if the municipality adopts an ordinance establishing a red light camera program. Houston did that. Houston did it originally in 2005, and then they amended it again in 2009. Under our charter provision for the repeal of ordinances, which is a referendum process, it requires that a citizen petition to call a referendum election has to be filed within 30 days after the adoption of the ordinance. Conversely, a petition for a charter amendment can be filed at any time. And in this instance, the charter amendment petition was filed years after the ordinance was adopted. So the camera company and also Councilmember Clutterbuck were maintaining that the charter amendment process available under state law could not be utilized to repeal an ordinance when there was a process for repeal of ordinance under the city charter, separate process. My interpretation and my argument was that the state law was supreme. There was no restriction as to what a charter amendment could be used for, at least no restriction that would be affected, really apply to this instance. There's a restriction in the sense that you can't have a charter amendment which, for example, would eliminate a pre-existing right or obligation. But there's nothing in the state law governing the charter amendment process which would preclude, on sites, that would preclude the use of a charter amendment to repeal an ordinance. So interestingly, the camera company is making the very same argument today in the context of this litigation that it was making before the matter was placed on the ballot. I believe now, as I believe then, that we had no alternative but to place it on the ballot. And you know, even if the judge were to say that the charter election is invalid, and I don't anticipate that he will, I would not, in retrospect, you know, have changed my advice. That's cutting edge law. This issue has never been raised before.
I mean, it seems to me that if there's an argument over whether or not an election is valid in the first place, I don't know, it seems to me that that should be decided before the election takes place. Well, why didn't that happen?
No, the law in this state, as a general rule, is that you can test that after an election, not before. First of all, there's hardly time to address it in advance. I mean, the Charter Amendment petition in the case of the red light cameras was submitted really kind of at the midnight hour. And we were facing a cutoff date for the calling of an election, ordering of an election under the Texas Election Code. So we had, you know, every bit of 2 days to make a decision on this. Now, you could not possibly litigate and reach any kind of final ruling on the issues. I mean, you go to a trial court. If you're dissatisfied with the decision of the trial court, you go to the Court of Appeals. If you're dissatisfied with the decision of the Court of Appeals, you go to the Texas Supreme Court. You know, none of that can readily occur prior to an election, when there's such a short timeline between when a petition is filed, election order is ordered, and an election is conducted. So if you look at the body of Texas case law on the issue of validity of elections, you will find that with very, very limited exception, the litigation all took place after the election was conducted.
And if the judge decides that this election was invalid, is that going to, what will the city do in that instance?
Well, firstly, we would appeal the judge's decision. We would have to, because it would be an interlocutory order, we'd have to have permission to file the appeal. But we would request that permission, because we wouldn't have a final judgment. And at that point in time, we're just going to have to assess the appropriate strategy with respect to the contract.
But you would not anticipate that the city would go back to putting using the red light cameras.
The mayor has been consistent in the view that it's her obligation to uphold the will of the voters, that has not changed.
Okay. I guess the only other question I have at this point is, you know, what do you anticipate being, you know, kind of your priorities for the coming year? Once you get past redistricting, and we get this lawsuit settled, is your office more reactive, or do you have an agenda?
I have no agenda per se, but nor is this office simply reactive. It is both reactive and proactive, because this is a proactive administration. It's a very proactive mayor. There are all kinds of serious issues facing this city, a lot of them driven by the economy and the budget crisis that we face. There are many different things that can be done to improve the way government operates here, which in turn will produce savings for the taxpayer. And that is very much what this mayor is about. You're turning government more into a business. Following that lead, I am always looking at ways that the city can improve what it does from a legal standpoint. And oftentimes that involves, you know, legislative changes at a local level, which, of course, the legal department is very much involved in. We've got a legislative session going on right now. We're trying to accomplish some changes in state law that we need to carry out priorities of the administration. For example, the urban renewal is very important. And we've got some city has some bills up in Austin that would the passage of which would be very helpful to us and to enable us to attack the problem of urban blight. We have a huge problem, as you know, with our pension systems, particularly the firefighter pension, and spending a lot of time on that as well. If we don't get any relief in the legislature, the possibility exists that we may have to look to the courthouse to see if we can obtain some relief. So there are many things that I'm doing now, and I certainly anticipate it will be doing, that are proactive in nature to try and assist the mayor in her carrying out her campaign promises and her goals to turn the city into a more efficient unit of government.
David Feldman, thank you very much for talking to me today.
Well, my pleasure.